This is the Medic Cast, January 10th, 2011.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We have a lot going on in tonight's show, and I want to make sure that you're all squared away. Again, this is our first episode of 2011 as we enter the sixth year here at the Medic Cast. Really exciting to look back and see all we've done over the last 5 years and what we are yet to do in this industry as we create a real channel and opportunity to talk about EMS issues every week here on this show and all the others like it. So it's really exciting to be part of this project. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, don't forget you can always catch me by email, podmedic@mac.com. And don't forget to check out the MedicCast blog. MedicCast.com/blog is your resource for all of the information discussed in each episode. There's a show notes link right at the top of the page. Go ahead and click that. You'll find the most recent episodes listed first, and you can scroll down to find the episode you're looking for. We have links to news items, also information and links in there associated with each week's tip of the week or interview segment, and all of that is there to provide you the information you need to get the additional in-depth information beyond what a brief 10 or 15 minute overview might provide for you. So make sure you are following up on that information. And again, that's at medicast.com/blog. Of course, don't forget, we have a voicemail line as well. Call in on the voicemail line if you'd like to catch up with us. 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC. Call in on the voicemail line. Let me know what you think about a particular segment or news item in the show and share your thoughts live with the other listeners when I play that back on the show. Please remember also you can catch up with me on Twitter and Facebook, twitter.com/podmedic and facebook.com/podmedic. And don't forget the MedicCast fan page. Growing all the time, over 2,000 fans of the fan page over there. You can just go to facebook.com/medicast and you will find the MedicCast fan page where you can click the like button right at the top of the page and then you will be able to follow the updates there and additional questions and information that is posted there each and every week, all available for you at the MedicCast fan page. So check that out over on the Facebook fan page. That's it. We'll get into our listener emails next. We got a couple of different emails this week, and I'll just jump into that. We've got listener Flo checking in from Australia, Florian Breitenbach, and he's checking in to let me know that he would definitely like to see me do some review of some basic cellular physiology, basically the Krebs cycle or things like that, having to do with more in-depth looks at what's going on under the hood, if you would, in relation to your patients. So I'm going to take that again to heart, and we'll see if we can't include that in a future tip of the week. And that was a suggestion from another listener, and then Flo was just checking in to say, yeah, definitely, he'd like to have that too. So thanks a lot for checking in all the way from down under. Hope things are going well for you there as you are heading into your summer months. I know there's some serious flooding going on in parts of Australia, so I hope that everyone you know is safe and well down there, Flo. And of course, I'll be keeping in touch with what's going on down there through all of the listeners. And you know, don't hesitate to send me pictures or links to anything that's going on so we can follow up and share that with the rest of the listener base. Also heard from listener Vicky checking in about hearing impaired patients and an issue that's passionate for her and something she'd like to see maybe us cover in a future episode, talking about how to handle patients. And you know, we have lots of patients that we come in contact with that have some sort of challenge with communication. So that might be a language difficulty, a barrier there, or some sort of barrier associated with a disability, hearing impairment, visually impaired. We need to overcome those and have ways and resources by which we can overcome those. So we might be looking into hearing impaired patients on a future episode here on the MedicCast. And Vicki, thanks a lot for that suggestion. I think it's valuable. We lived in a town where college had a program for hearing impaired students in their graduate school. And so every summer, my parents rented out a basement apartment to some graduate students in that hearing impaired program. And so it was, you know, we got to learn a little bit about sign language and talking to people. And so I think that it's something that we can address in a future episode on a tip of the week, perhaps on here on the show. So Vicki, thanks a lot. That's a great idea. And keep in touch. Let us know how things are going. Finally, on the last email here, got an email in from listener Chris. Chris has been a longtime listener of the show, just checking in. There's a information on a recent NPR story that he sent a link in to me about, and we might include that in a future news episode or news segment, looking at critical incident stress debriefings and critical incident stress management associated with EMS. And so it's interesting to look at how these types of things affect us, dealing with patient deaths, with line of duty deaths, and what we can do to adequately deal with the stresses we encounter in the course of our work. And it's not a question of if you're going to deal with some sort of critical incident stress. It's really just a question of when it's going to happen to you. No one who works in this business for any length of time avoids a situation where you have critical incident stress to deal with. And so it's really important to recognize when you have something that's causing you some issues, whether it's sleeplessness, restlessness, agitation, behavioral changes. There's a lot of things you can do to recognize it for yourself. And then you need to go through the resources in your company and organization to seek some assistance when necessary. Sometimes it's easy to recognize when there might be critical incident stress, and organizations are good at recognizing, you know, mass casualty incidents involving children, things like that, where they say, you know, this is going to affect us strongly. But it could be something that's affecting you personally from a call, and you need to be able to articulate that and then get the assistance you need. One person that I have had on the show in the past and will again in the future, I'm sure, is Dan McGuire from CISM Perspectives. And he is a nationwide educator on critical incident stress, line of duty death, and other things for all branches of emergency response, including police, fire, and EMS. And Dan's talked about this, so check out, if you go over to mediccast.com/blog, you can search there on the MedicCast blog and find past episodes dealing with critical incident stress and critical incident stress management, because it's not all about a single debriefing. It really is managing a critical incident and the stress associated with it over time. Multiple revisiting and perhaps longer-term counseling, all of these things are part of a comprehensive package. So again, thanks a lot, Chris, for checking in. You can also check in, just like Chris and Vicki and Flo did. Go ahead and shoot me an email, podmedic@mac.com, or call in on the voicemail line. No voicemails this week, so maybe you'll be the next voicemail I play on the show. Call in 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC, and leave your impressions on some of the things we've talked about so far on the show. Let's jump on into this week's news, and I'm going to lead off with a story on, let me find my mouse over here, lead off with a story on murder pic. Do you put a murder picture on your Facebook page? Well, if you do, you're going to get in trouble. And what astounds me about this particular story, this comes out of an EMT in Staten Island who took a picture of a murder victim and posted it on his Facebook page. What? I'm sorry. I'm a little shocked. And the reason I bring this up is just because sometimes people do things without really thinking about them. I don't think people understand that Facebook is a public forum, that things you post there, any picture you post on Facebook is really open to public viewing unless you go through some pretty onerous steps in the background on your settings to turn off all access to the pictures you post. Pictures are one of the things that are pretty darn public on Facebook, actually. People can go to your profile page, and it might say on there, people can can only view this profile if you're friends with this person, but their pictures will still show up in like the iPhone app, for instance. So you need to be aware that anything you post on there is considered public. And the other side of it is, what the heck is someone thinking taking pictures of a victim, especially a strangling victim in that situation, and then posting it for personal use? That's just obviously wrong. This individual has been dealt with, received pled guilty to official misconduct and disorderly conduct, received 200 hours of community service, and has been forbidden to ever work as an EMT again. So there are risks, but I would say to you that your station or your organization, you should understand, first of all, what the risks and benefits are to having a social media presence, and understand how your organization feels about that. There are some free speech rights associated with having that page and presence in a social media sense, and the National Labor Relations Board has ruled in favor of individuals who have blasted their boss on Facebook. Basically, they've been told that that is a permitted form of free speech. However, there are restrictions, and posting a patient's picture is a violation of that patient's confidentiality that is part of your job as an EMT and medical professional. So you should not be posting those types of things for your own personal use. Now, there may be other options and other things that we can think about here, and you really need to understand what your rights and responsibilities are for your protocols, your state, and your area. But there may be, if you're an educator, there may be options whereby you can use pictures from an accident scene or something to help during an educational session for specific educational use. You'll have to make sure that you are protecting patient confidentiality in those situations appropriately and to the extent that you can, but that is allowed for educational and training purposes if you need to, as long as your organization allows it. So don't just walk in and say, well, the PodMedic told me I could take pictures of accident scenes and use them for education, and I want to be an educator someday. Not going to float. I don't care. You need to understand your own rules and regulations. Also, if you're a supervisor listening to this, this is probably an opportunity for you to start thinking about what is the social media policy for your organization. It isn't enough to say no social media. First off, I think that's obviously, because of my standpoint in social media, I think that's the wrong way to go. But there's a lot of reasons for that. Partly because this is a form of communication that people have with family members and things, just like a phone or texting. And so, if you're going to allow your individuals who are at work to use some personal time to make phone calls and conduct some business when they need to, this is part of it. So you're going to need to relax some access and roots. But you can have some reasonable restrictions, and you can have, I think, should have a policy in place to talk about what's appropriate and not appropriate. Heck, it's an easy training session. I know that myself and people like Carissa O'Brien, who we work together in some of the conferences we attend, we have gone into companies and talked to them about social media policy, and we can do that for your organization. But you should be thinking about this from that standpoint. If you don't have a social media policy, you should come up with one, and not just have one that says no social media, because that is like saying we're no longer going to answer our phones. That's not really a valid option in this day and age. When you have over 500 million people on Facebook, you're really turning off access to the community you serve by doing that. Next up in the news is a look at a rather alarming study I found over at WebMD.com. And this is a study from the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And, you know, federal government agencies, they all have these initials and things. This is a SAMHSA is the way that these initials spell out. But this is an organization, you know, the federal division that is responsible for tracking drug abuse and mental health services. One of the things they came up with in a recent study and survey was the alarming number of 30 million Americans admitted that they drove under the influence of some alcohol, drug, or something. Over 30 million people said, yeah, I drove drunk last year. That's alarming to me. Where have we missed getting this message out there? How are we still, in this day and age, have people that decide that it's okay, that they're okay to drive that way? I think that this is an educational issue. I think it's something that we need to redouble our efforts along with other organizations in our jurisdictions and reach out to the public in such a way that we can continue to educate. And that means start early. Talk to kids about it when you visit local elementary schools. Offer to come in and offer a safety briefing. Work with your local police agencies. They often have anti-drug task forces associated with going in educating in the schools. Work with them. Come in and bring that medical perspective to their presentations. They'd love to help, and it's a great way to work together and build those partnerships that are so important when we need to work together in the field. So this is an alarming study. Basically, they found that on average about 13.2% of people 16 and older drove under the influence of alcohol in the last year. About 4.3% admitted to driving on illicit drugs other than alcohol. And this is, while it's down slightly from the previous year, it is not, you know, a small number. 30 million people. You know, we're lucky any of us got anywhere last year with all the drunks on the road. So it's kind of alarming to me, but I also think it's an opportunity for us to reach out and take hold of that prevention aspect of our provider certifications. We have a duty to act in a preventive role as well as a treatment role, and we can do more to educate and prevent drunk driving injuries by getting in the forefront and talking about this. You know, take this link and article and send it to a local newspaper and say, hey, I'd like you to come and interview our chief about this so we can talk about the impact of drunk driving on people in our community. And so you can usually find local reporters would love to have a story handed to them on a plate like that. They've got an AP story, an article like this, a release, and they can turn around and bring your angle into it and make it a local story. And they don't have to do near as much work as if they'd started it off from scratch. So let's think about ways we can approach this, and you may be surprised at how effective it is in reaching out and reminding people. You know, if you can put this article out there in your paper, or you can hold an educational session at a community center in your community, and you get one person to second guess and say, you know what, I'm not going to drive drunk. I can call a cab, or I can call a neighbor to come get me, or get somebody else to drive me home. You know, you will have potentially saved lives in your community just by taking the time to go do that, if you can just get one person to think twice before they do this. So that's what we need to do. We need to think about it in small, easy steps. 30 million, big number, not something we're going to put much of a dent in. But if you start looking at it in terms of your community, can you get one person this year to stop driving drunk in your community? If you can do that, you've made a major improvement and increased the safety of the highways. Finally, a look at an article on reasons why adults need vaccines. What? We talk about vaccines, we talk about kids, right? Well, no, there are a lot of situations where adults need vaccines as well. And so it's one of those things we talk about. We're in the midst of flu season right now, and a lot of people are getting the flu. So what does that mean? Well, did you have your flu shot this year? If you didn't, you probably should have. It's not too late to get the flu shot for this season. And it seems to be having some positive effect for people that are coming in contact with patients who have influenza, a virus that is floating around in our seasonal flu this year. So again, there's things, reasons there. But I found a great article that you can follow up on and look and see some of the 12 reasons why adults need vaccines. First off, your childhood vaccines may no longer be effective. Sometimes they wear off over time and you need a booster. So there are things like your tetanus shot. Generally, you need a tetanus shot every 10 years. And so if you haven't had a tetanus shot in the last 10 years, you're due for one. There are other things. When you get vaccinated for something that you weren't vaccinated for before, you actually protect those around you. It's called herd immunity, and it means that the more members of a group that are vaccinated and immune to an illness, it means that those that are not vaccinated or can't take the vaccine for medical reasons, they are less likely to get sick because there are fewer people that can give it to them. This is important. So you keep your family safer. You keep your people around you safer. I would urge you to check out the rest of these. There's 12 of them. They're all very good. This makes a great teaching point in your community or in your service to talk about the importance and necessity of vaccines. And I would urge you to think along those lines, because there's always different things we can do in the same old educational classes. And this is just one of the things that would make a nice one-hour training session for the providers, if you're the training officer in your organization. I would take the 12 vaccines and run with it, and create some PowerPoint and do some little bit additional research, and you'll be done. You've got a training session set up for you. So take it as a gift from the PodMedic. Hey, listen, if you like these news items and you want to find more information about them, including the other 10 items in the 12 reasons adults need vaccines too, you can head over and check out the links to the news items in the show notes for this episode. Again, mediccast.com/blog. Click the link for show notes in the top right corner or top left corner of the page, and go ahead and find this episode and find and follow up on these news links. Of course, if you're over there and you sign up for the newsletter, you'll actually get all of these links sent to you by email. So you can get those links and follow up on them yourself directly. And I would urge you to do that so that you can get a little bit more in depth beyond what I've talked about. Time now for this week's tip and trick of the week. And this week I thought we'd talk about hospital and healthcare acquired infections. You know, we talked in that last news item about vaccines and vaccinations, but you know, one of the things is that we actually live in a very dirty environment when we are in the healthcare field. While many people, especially in hospitals, might think that these are pristine and sterile environments, in fact, the opposite is the case. A lot of opportunistic bugs live in and around a healthcare facility, and an ambulance could be considered a healthcare facility. And I think that this is one of those things that you should start thinking about the back of your ambulance as a, you know, mini operating theater, emergency room, whatever you want to think about. And how clean does it need to be? Well, it needs to be cleaner than it probably is. So let's talk a little bit about healthcare acquired infections in this week's episode tip of the week. So we're going to be talking about hospital or healthcare associated infections, and there's a lot of different things. HAI is the standard abbreviation for that in CDC and other locations. HAI can stand for hospital associated infections, hospital acquired infections, healthcare acquired infections, or healthcare associated infections. They all are essentially the same thing. And we're going to talk a little bit about them because they're important for us to understand, both because we are part of the healthcare system and could be providing opportunities for these infections to occur, and also because we transport between hospital and healthcare facilities, and we may be looking at dealing with patients who are coming from one facility and going to another, and you may know about infection problems in a specific facility and want to know what they mean when they say there's a C. diff outbreak in this nursing home. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. We're also going to look at incidence and costs in the United States, types of healthcare-associated infections, and common pathogens that you might see if you want to know a little bit about microbiology. We'll cover briefly on that. Also, prevention really is the key, and some things to do for prevention. And then what you need to do to monitor yourself and others, some considerations to keep in mind. So when we talk about healthcare-acquired infections, what are we talking about? These are infections that patients acquire, and I'm using the CDC definition here, during the course of receiving healthcare treatment for other conditions. They didn't come to see us for an infection. We treated them for something else, and they got an infection along the way. Infections may be associated with a couple of different things. A particular device might cause an infection. It might be a procedure that is more likely to cause an infection, or specific facility types that would cause certain types of infections. There are also many, many different pathogens, specific diseases or specific bacteria, viruses, or fungi that can cause a healthcare-acquired infection. We think about MRSA, or we think about HIV or hepatitis, but there are really many, many things that we need to be aware of. So we'll talk about that as well. What does this cost us? Well, national reporting really just started, and healthcare agencies and organizations have had to report for the last few years, but the data is starting to come in. But 1.7 million reports of healthcare-associated infections in 2007 when they just started reporting. It's obviously going to be going up, won't it, as more people start reporting these things. This costs the nation up to $45 million a year. And that's a number that, think about the savings that could go back into your community if you could get maybe $100,000 back in healthcare costs that saved because we were able to reduce the infection rates in our communities. Why do I say that we can get that? Well, think about this. They talk about prevention measures, and they say $20 million or more could be saved with basic prevention procedures. $20 million, that's half. All right, that's nearly half of what we said was the cost each year. We can save 50%. We could apply that money in other ways to better improve and provide health care. Different types that we see out there, there are healthcare acquired infections associated with devices that we use when we treat patients. So what do we mean by this? Well, in the hospital setting, you'd think about central lines, urinary tract infections associated with catheterization, and also ventilator-associated pneumonias that were where the bacteria and other pathogens will actually migrate down the ET tube into the patient. And during the ventilation cycle and cause pneumonia associated with having that tube in, that over time, even if it was clean when it went in, is not as clean as it is as it was in the beginning. For us in the EMS sector, what are we talking about when we say devices? Well, laryngoscope blades. Are you cleaning them or are you using a disposable blade? There are things that need to be done to clean these devices adequately. And if you don't know how to do it properly, then you're not protecting your patient population. So yeah, laryngoscope blades, and really the handles too, because you're holding onto the handles. We need to wipe these things down and then appropriately sterilize if we're going to be using reusable laryngoscope blades. Also, we can think about any of our tools that might come in contact with an open wound on a patient. We apply splints to patients. If we can clean the patient slightly before we apply these devices to an open wound, hopefully we've dressed it appropriately, but you know, there are going to be things we need to think about. When we're using sterile dressings, we need to try to keep those dressings sterile as long as possible. So let's keep these things in mind. Anything we use that comes in contact with patients, IVs. We need to be cleaning the patient's IV sites carefully before we start that IV line. It doesn't take that long to do, and it's really a shame if you save a cardiac arrest victim and they die of a massive infection a week later because the IV started in the field wasn't dealt with properly. So these are things that we really need to keep in mind, that there are devices we have and use in the field that can cause infection. Do I say that they do? No. If you do your job right and are aware of careful procedures and protection, then no, you should be able to take care of these patients without increasing the infection risk. But that's why we're having this segment, so we can actually talk about that. There are specific procedures that are more likely. We talked about, intubation is going to put a patient at risk for infection. If we can manage a patient without intubating them using something like CPAP, then we can stave off the risk that asthmatic patient is going to be taken in and put on a ventilator for 2 days and put them at increased risk for infection when their body's fighting something else. Specific facilities, long-term care facilities are often places where certain infections will crop up and just kind of linger for periods of time. And you got C. diff and MRSA and other infectious types that are out there that you may be finding more likely associated with a certain patient population or a facility that you come in contact with. And opportunistic infections. And this is one of the reasons why we really need to be better about cleaning our units as in general, wiping down all our surfaces. You know, you got those nice grab bars over your head in the ambulance so you can, ride along and not fall over while the ambulance is moving. How many times have you reached up there with a gloved hand after you've bandaged a wound? And who looks on top of that bar and says, oh, I guess we should wipe that down? if you can't even see that there's blood up there, but the next time you're in the ambulance and you reach up there with a bare hand or even a gloved hand and you reach up to that bar and then touch your patient, you've had an opportunity to transfer something to the new patient. So we need to be very much more careful. And we pick up sick people, they are already ill, they're already dealing with a medical issue that's taxing their immune system and their body's response, and so their body is more susceptible to other things. That's what we mean when we say opportunistic infections. What kind of pathogens are we talking about here? Well, bacterial, viral, and fungal infections are the three types of infections. Bacterial infections, the gamut. Almost anything that can cause an infection will be present as a healthcare acquired infection. But C. diff, C. sordelli, Enterobacter, Acinetobacter, Klebsiella, MRSA, VRSA, TB, VRE, and more. There are just a lot of them out there. And some of these infections aren't normally infectious to regular people. If you're a healthy individual, there's Pseudomonas in the soil everywhere. And it doesn't usually cause an infection. But to some patient populations, such as a patient who is experiencing full-blown AIDS symptoms, one of those symptoms is the presence of opportunistic infections caused by things like Pseudomonas, which is around us in everyday life. And when it sees an opportunity to infect, it will. Normally, we kill it off without even thinking about it. It's not even hard to do. But when our immune system's compromised, we become much more at risk. Viral infections include HIV, hepatitis, we talked about them already, influenza. What? Yeah, that's what I said. That's why we're supposed to be getting the vaccine for the yearly flu every year. Why? Because if we are not vaccinated, we are more likely to pass it on to our patients. If one patient makes you sick, you can take it home to your family, or you can also take it to the next patient. So if you can influence yourself by getting appropriately vaccinated, you can stop passing these things along. Norovirus is another virus, and there's others out there, but certainly something to keep in mind. And then you have fungal infections, and these are opportunistic infections in most cases because the patients are usually able to fend off fungal infections, except in situations where the body's bacterial resources, we have bacteria living all over us. Some of them are opportunistic or some of them are beneficial and actually help keep the fungal population down. So we have little battlegrounds going on us all the time. Preventing healthcare acquired infections is something that's everyone's responsibility, and I can't say that enough. I don't care who you are. You may be the maintenance guy in an ambulance company and don't even ride the ambulance, but you're the maintenance guy. If you're in the back of that ambulance and you are fixing the hinge on a door or installing a new outlet so that you can charge something else on the bench, well, guess what? It's your job, just as much as it's everybody else's job, to make sure that you're cleaning up after yourself, that you're washing your hands before and between working on different units so that you don't transfer things from unit to unit to unit to unit. It's your job to do that just as much as it's the paramedic's job to do that. So I want you to understand it's a team effort. There was, in the recent Recovery Act, where billions of dollars were pumped back into the economy by the federal government, $50 million of that was actually earmarked for healthcare-acquired infection prevention programs. So there is money out there to do research, and you could probably look and see if there's grant money available to actually do a research project on healthcare-acquired infections in the EMS setting and start using it to culture ambulances and see what lives out there in our units. You might be surprised. Generally, how are we going to prevent this? Personal protective equipment, universal precautions. Everything you do in your annual bloodborne pathogen training is really the stuff you're going to do to protect yourself from healthcare-acquired infections. But also, appropriate use of PPE protects the patient, too, from the last patient you had. Hand washing, hand washing, hand washing. Can't say it enough, but it is one of the things that is the easiest thing to do. It's also the thing that is least often done regularly by medical professionals. It's easy to do and wash your hands between patients in a setting where you're in a hospital and you have sinks everywhere. In the ambulance, not so easy. Make sure you have plenty of the waterless hand gel. Make sure you wash your hands when you get to the hospital and have dropped your patient off. Wash your hands before and after you eat, and wash your hands after cleaning and stocking the ambulance so that, again, you don't transfer things from one unit to the next. Environmental cleaning in your facilities is an important part of the process. Again, every nook and cranny is a potential hiding place for some pathogen. And I guarantee you that as our ambulances are tight little units and we end up packed into the corners sometimes when a cardiac arrest is going on and you're the extra provider to switch off and do compressions, they may have you standing in the corner with your back up against the wall and you didn't realize that you have something on your turnout gear and you're pressing that all up against the wall now. So that whole wall is infected with something. You have to wipe down all surfaces on a regular basis as part of your standard cleaning routine. And certainly, between calls, all of the patient contact surfaces need to be wiped down between each and every patient call. Collaborations with other members of the healthcare community are very important. I would work with your local hospitals. They have infection control doctors and nurses who I think would be glad to come out and talk with you about infection control and how you can affect change. This is something they have to work on in the hospitals, and you bring patients to their hospital and are part of that chain of custody. So they would love to have you do what you can do to stop infections from occurring. Because, you know, if it happened in the ambulance, guess what? It's going to show up in the hospital 2 days later, and now it's the hospital's problem. So you're part of the process, but you may not be recognized as part of the cause. And this is a whole staff effort, and I mean that from the person who's maintenance on the ambulance all the way to the top provider. It's a community team staff effort, and it's something that you should keep in mind. What do we do to make that work as a team effort? Well, you're going to monitor yourself and others. You need to make it a game. Make it something that everybody does where we all remind each other to wash our hands all the time. Provide a reward to that person who's reminded people the most to wash their hands. Keep your ambulances clean. Monitor home and family. If you are sick, don't come to work. Now, I know that's hard because you're not getting paid, but employers need to really look hard at this. It doesn't do a service to our patients by making sick providers take care of them. And if you are sick and are providing, use a mask if you have a respiratory illness. Use appropriate personal protective equipment to act as a barrier between you and your patients from your end. Educate your patients and your family members too. Talk to your patients about hand washing. You know, if you pick up a patient with a really bad case of the flu and you're taking them to the hospital because they've got respiratory difficulty and they're really one of those patients that is at risk for dying from the seasonal flu, you know, talk to them and their family members about, hey, look, remember the importance of hand washing. It's going to help him get better faster, and it's going to help keep the rest of your family from getting this. So you can do some education on the way to the hospital as well. Monitor each other and your station. There actually, a few weeks ago, I put out a link about an iPhone app and other smartphone apps that are associated with being able to track this. So you can actually put somebody in charge of being the infection control monitor, and they can observe how many people are washing their hands regularly between moving from unit to unit, between patients and whatnot. They can track this in the phone. It tracks it, makes statistics, puts them together for you, and will even submit those statistics for you to a central body so that everybody can collect that data, and it's free. So look that up. And finally, measurement, tracking, and research. You know, we don't do enough research in EMS. We rely on the hospital sector to do research in our field, and you know, where are they doing their research? In the hospital. It doesn't have anything to do with us. We need to have effective research on what types of infections are coming from the ambulance sector and how we can move to prevent it and what are the most cost-effective ways to prevent the transmission of illness and disease in our sector. So there's research and tracking and monitoring available for us. We just need to start doing it, and it's something we owe to our communities. There are resources in the show notes for this and the other episodes, but of course, the links and resources are there for you. Great resources from the CDC, including some printable documents and signs and things you can put up to encourage hand washing. So, you know, take advantage of the free resources and use them. Also, there is a great article there from the American Association of Critical Care Nurses on awards recognizing the elimination of healthcare-associated infections in different facilities. And I see no reason why we can't have something similar to that in the EMS sector to look at how we are preventing it in our area of the healthcare system. And finally, just other links and articles that you'll find associated with these links. So definitely follow up over at medicast.com/blog. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and remind all of you to make sure you are following up on the information presented in this episode by heading over to the MedicCast site at medicast.com/blog. You'll find the link to the show notes at the top of the page. You can also sign up for the email newsletter right there on the front page and get all those links sent directly to you in your email box if you want. But you should definitely take the information presented here in a broad overview and then make sure you are going and looking more in depth so that you know how it applies to your own scope of practice or instructional guidelines. I'd love to hear back from you about what you thought about this or any other episode or an article on the site. So you can, of course, leave a comment on any of the articles over at the MedicCast blog, but you can also send me an email. Shoot me those emails to podmedic@mac.com, and I'd love to hear from you. I try to get back to everybody that sends me an email, and I may share your email and suggestion or question or comment on a future episode here during the listener mail segment. So get in touch with me, shoot me those emails now so that I can include them and have your voice be heard here on the show. Of course, you can have your voice literally heard. Call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC, or you can contact me via Twitter and Facebook. You'll find me under the handle PodMedic in both those locations, and you can become a fan of the MedicCast fan page over on Facebook as well, and that's available for you at facebook.com/MedicCast. Just click the like button at the top of the page, and heck, you're good to go as a fan of the MedicCast. Time to close out the show, and let's go ahead and close it out with some PodSafe music. This is Matthew Ebel coming up here with the song Downtown. I've played his songs here before. Follow up on the links in the show notes, and I'll let him know you heard it here on the MedicCast. And, of course, there's also a link there to get his songs over at iTunes. So if you like what you hear, pick up his music and share it with folks and let him know that you heard it here on the show and by purchasing one of his songs. And it's cheap and inexpensive and a great way to say thank you to these independent artists for sharing their music with us. That's it. I'll be back again next week with another episode. We try to get shows out here every Monday morning for you so you can wake up bright and early and kick off your week with the MedicCast. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. Until next time, don't forget, scene safety, BSI. The future past the end, never knows.
never made it to the road. Now he drives the legs, but he's looking for sex. A cheap whiskey in a bag full of happiness. He'll suck you in with a sinister grin, a stick pin, and a spin that you're gonna win if you go downtown. Sell, or your daddy gonna raise hell. He gives you money behind.